Boyd. Up next on Think, if you've questioned the purpose of your existence, and lately who hasn't, maybe you're asking the wrong questions. We'll spend this hour with philosopher and psychologist Frank Martella, who reminds us that while it may be impossible to discover the meaning of life, we all have the capacity to find meaning in life. We'll talk with Martella about why it likely never occurred to our ancestors to ask the meaning of life, about why happiness as a life goal is probably a bad idea, and about concrete things we can all do to build a sense of significance into the things we do every day. Our conversation starts after a short break. In Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Things are different today. Our lives are safer and more materially comfortable, but spiritually and psychologically we suffer. What is the point of our lives? Why are we even here? Maybe the answers elude us because we're asking the wrong questions. Frank Martella is here to talk with us about that. He's a philosopher and researcher of psychology specializing in the meaning of life at Aalto University in Helsinki. His new book is called A Wonderful Life, Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. Frank, welcome to Think.
Hi, welcome. It's great to be here.
You note that we are hardwired to seek meaning. What can go wrong with us when we don't have meaning in our lives?
Yeah, so I think that human beings are hardwired to seek meaning. That's true, because it's part of like our nature. Like, we are able to question things that, you know, unlike animals, we can stop in the middle of the action and ask, why am I doing this? And through asking this why question, if you ask it like too many times, we end up with these more existential questions about why do we exist? And even though it's like, so having this capacity for reflection, it's a blessing, but it's also a curse, because it's not always easy to find this answer to this question. So that sometimes it might be that the answer seems to be there, but the more we question it, the more we like look it from different angles, the harder it sometimes might be to find any satisfactory answer to the question, like, why am I doing whatever am I doing, or why am I living the life the way that I'm living it?
There was a time when we looked to religion to answer any question that we couldn't figure out, and now we look to science for a lot of that. How has shifting from religious explanations to scientific ones affected our confidence that we know what our lives mean in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, I guess like thinking about the grand scheme of things was easier a couple of centuries ago, because yeah, there was like this religious framework. And like basically everybody around you shared the same religious framework. So people were like much less exposed to people with different ideas about how things work out. And also the scientific worldview didn't like really exist. So that was not in the picture. And I think what the scientific worldview actually did, that it was the first worldview that in a way questioned that human beings are at the center of the universe, at the center of the existence, that within all the religious traditions, usually human beings have some like special role to play. They're like the gods are interested in the human being and so forth. But in the scientific worldview, suddenly human beings were like pushed out of the pedestal. They were just, you know, products of evolution. There was like nothing like essential differentiating human beings for any animals or anything like that. And the whole vast universe had existed like millions of years before us we came here, and it will exist millions of years after us. So all of this made suddenly our existence seem like more precarious and more kind of like accidental and random. And that was like where we got this idea that perhaps like life doesn't have this some grand purpose at all.
So we try to distract ourselves from our own sense of insignificance. How well does that work?
Yeah, I guess like sometimes the modern lifestyle seems to be like some kind of like distraction from trying to ask these existential questions. So people try to keep them so busy that they would never have this time to like be alone with themselves. Because like when you're alone with yourself, there's always the risk that you start to question your life choices, you start to question why are you living the life the way you are living. So for many, it's like it's the easier option is just like keep yourself busy, that you're always doing something. And when you're not doing something, keep some kind of media open. Watch some TV series, or like listen to some music or whatever, that you wouldn't like end up alone with your own thoughts.
You quote an international Gallup poll that finds people in wealthy societies are far more likely than people in very poor ones to feel like their lives lack meaning. What could explain that, given that day-to-day existence is certainly more challenging for people who live in poverty?
Yeah, when you have this like international comparisons of happiness or like well-being, in these comparisons, it's usually the basic result is that, you know, people in the richer countries are on average happier than people in the very poor countries. So like poverty is something that deprives us from like having high levels of well-being, because then we are like suffering and we have like hard time to get these basic necessities satisfied. But for meaning in life, it's true that, you know, there's like this one poll by Gallup in 134 different countries found out that the relationship was the other way around. In richer countries, there were more people who were saying that their life doesn't have any purpose or meaning to it. And I think that, as we already mentioned, like religion might be like one of the key explanations, because the richer countries tend to be the countries where there's like more secularism, more people who are not religious. And that seemed to be like one of the key explanations why people in very poor countries, but very, very religious countries, all, basically all of people were saying that their life has a purpose. But then in the richer countries with more secular populations, there were like more people who were questioning whether life has a purpose at all.
What is happiness exactly?
So I guess like there's like many different definitions of happiness. And one thing to note about these like these international comparisons is that what they are asking in these questions is about this like general satisfaction with your life. So they're asking that on a scale from 0 to 10, where 10 is the best possible life and 0 is the worst possible life, where would you put yourself on this scale? So that's the basic question that this Gallup World Poll asks, like in 160 different countries, like thousands of people in every country. And then they calculate averages of that to see which countries are the happiest in the world. So that's like one way of thinking about happiness, is that this general satisfaction with your life. But of course, another way of thinking about happiness would be to think about, you know, having positive emotions, lacking negative emotions. And that's already like, you know, even though like being satisfied with your life and having positive emotions, they tend to be like co-occur to some degree, but they can be like also separate. People can go through suffering, but at the same time still be like satisfied with their life in general, even though right now they're feeling like, you know, some sadness or other negative emotions. And I wouldn't say that one way of thinking about happiness is better than the other, but I would say that, you know, that when we think about happiness, we should be like thinking about more than one thing. That, you know, having this richer notion of happiness allows us to like dig deeper into how the human beings are actually experiencing their lives and like get more information about that, what would be like good and bad in their lives.
I don't get the sense that you want people to be unhappy or that you are especially unhappy yourself. So why do you think that happiness as a life goal is a bad idea?
Yeah, it's true that I don't have like anything against happiness as such. And why would I have? Like, I'm happy when I'm happy, so that's a good thing. But at the same time, I feel that, you know, it doesn't work very well as life goal. That there are certain things in life that, you know, are not so good, not so easy to achieve when you are striving for them directly. And I think happiness is one of those things, because if you're trying to like maximize too much your own happiness, if you focus too much on like, you know, optimizing your happiness levels, that makes it, even based on research, that makes you like less happy on average. And the reason is that people who are like trying to maximize their happiness, they're not satisfied with anything. Whatever happens in their life, they're thinking that, okay, this thing made me quite happy. Why didn't it make me even happier? So like the ability to enjoy life as it is like disappears if you're like all the time focusing on future happiness, the future optimized levels of happiness, instead of like enjoying life as it comes. So in that sense, I think like happiness is one of these things that we should strive more indirectly, that when we concentrate on things that make our lives meaningful, then happiness comes kind of like as a side product without us having to concentrate on happiness as such.
So there's this grocery store in my neighborhood called Aldi. I think it might be related to Lidl, which you have in Finland. Do you know the store I'm talking about, supermarket?
Not quite sure.
Okay, well, it's okay. It's a store that they sell pretty much everything you might need to buy, but there are not a lot of choices of brands, right? There's just a couple things that are each in each category rather than 1,000 kinds of breakfast cereal or bread or that sort of thing. And I find that I like shopping there because I just have to decide what I'm buying, but I don't have to decide among many different versions of it. We all think we want choice, so I wonder why we get so stressed out when we have too many choices.
Yeah, but it's true. Like, according to research, like, you know, some level of choice is good, but like too much choice actually like makes us less satisfied with what we ultimately come to buy. So that, you know, if there's like only three brands of cereal that you have to decide from, then they probably are quite different from each other. So it's like easy to make the choice that this is the best one for that I enjoy most, this one. But if there's 25 different cereals, there's probably going to be like three different options that are all almost as good as each other. And it's like harder to make the choice. And then when you commit to buying one thing, that you still like have like some second thoughts about, should I still have bought this like other brand? So like, not having any choice is not good for human beings, but having too many selections already like is like detrimental for our sense of satisfaction with whatever we come to choose in the end.
So you tell us that we should strive for thinking about happiness as just a feeling rather than something we should always be pursuing. What changes when we look at happiness that way?
Yeah, so I think like in our modern culture, we have come to like put happiness on a certain like pedestal that probably because of like, you know, because the religion and the tradition had like lost their like power to guide us in lives, that then we have been like looking for like new kind of like ideals, new things to like strive for in life. And happiness has been seen as a good option, that something that, you know, that we obviously want in our life. So like many people are thinking nowadays that, you know, happiness should be like our like grand life goal, that, you know, your goal in life should be to become more happy. And even though like it's like not all bad that we think we are like conscious about our own happiness and think about that, but there's like when you make it into a goal, it also means that, you know, that you can, that when you are unhappy in your life, it becomes like a double the burden if you think that your goal in life is to become happy, because then you're not only are you unhappy, but at the same time you already also feel that, you know, that you have like failed in this task in life that you were put here to do. So in that sense, I think like, you know, the culture of putting happiness as a goal, it's like it's not always a good thing, and also it's like historically it's quite a new thing that, you know, a couple of centuries ago we didn't think about happiness as much as we do. It wasn't like any kind of like life goal for many people. And even nowadays, like in many cultures, like around outside the Western world, the happiness is not like as important life goal as it is for us. For example, I talked with this one Chinese professor of psychology, and he was telling that, you know, if he thinks about his parents' generation and those people there, they were actually like quite often like bragging about how unhappy they are. So like being unhappy was kind of like a badge of honor, because it showed that you have like sacrificed for your family, you have sacrificed for the society, and like and that was like considered as much more like noble thing to do than to care about something so trivial as your own happiness. So in that sense, like, I think the balance is somewhere in between. That, you know, it's not good thing to, you know, to make sacrifice yourself for others and not care about your happiness at all, but it's not good thing to only think about your own happiness. So the balance is something that, you know, be aware of your happiness and what makes you happy, but not make it into like a grand life goal, and realize that there's going to be moments in everybody's life when they are not happy. So like being unhappy is totally normal. It's part of life. But, you know, everybody has like situations where they feel unhappy, and thinking that we should all the time be happy is kind of like can actually harm us, because it's an impossible ideal that nobody can actually realize in their life.
My guest is Frank Martella, a philosopher and researcher of psychology specializing in the meaning of life at the University of Aalto in Helsinki, Finland. His book is called A Wonderful Life: Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frank Martella, who is a philosopher and researcher of psychology specializing in the meaning of life. He's written a book called A Wonderful Life: Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Frank, you live in Finland, which keeps coming up on international surveys as the happiest country on earth. I would love to visit someday. When I get there, will I be able to see that happiness? Will it be obvious to me?
Probably not, because I think like the if you walk the streets of Helsinki, the capital of Finland, I don't think like people will be like smiling there more than people in some other cities. I think like when the kind of this World Happiness Report came up with the fact that Finland is the world's happiest country, the Finnish people were actually like really surprised, and they started to immediately like question the whole survey that hey, there must be something wrong with the whole thing, because Finnish people don't think about themselves as particularly happy people. I think like Finnish people have like kind of like this a bit like melancholic self-image that we like to listen to like sad music, or like it's either it's like sad music, or then it's like hard rock kind of music. So like one of these options. So in that sense, like if you come to visit Finland, you probably wouldn't like immediately recognize this as the happiest place on earth. And even the weather plays a role, because like it's a very northern country with like dark winters and coldness. So yeah, that also isn't like our typical image of a happy place.
So why are humans so insistent on having meaning in our lives? What is it about us that needs that in a different way from other animals who are usually, they appear to be pretty satisfied as long as their needs are met?
Yeah, so it comes down to this, like our ability to question things. That like when we talk about happiness, it seems like quite natural to talk about the happiness of a dog, for example. That when we see a dog, we can like quite immediately tell if the dog is like feeling happy or if it's feeling sad. But saying that hey, the dog seems to be thinking about the meaning of life, or the dog seems to be having like some kind of existential crisis, that's usually not something that we hear so often about. So that seems to be like something uniquely human. That only human beings can have an existential crisis. Only human beings can question their existence, and it's about this like our capacity for reflection that it comes down to, that we are able to reflect on things, and we are kind of like looking for like we are able to like trying to justify our actions. We are able to question, why am I doing this? What is the ultimate justification for doing this or that action? And when we are looking for this, then we are kind of like looking for the value of something. And being able to not only experience things, but reflect on things and think about what should I value, what should I strive for. That's like uniquely human, and that's where our need for meaningfulness comes from.
Who invented this question of what is the meaning of life?
That's actually quite an interesting question, because quite often when we think about this question, we think about it as some kind of eternal question that has been asked since the dawn of mankind. And that's also what I thought, just a few years ago. But then when I digged into the history, it turned out that that even though human beings have been asking some kind of existential questions from times immemorial, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, for example, or like talks about this human being like kind of like this that our that how futile our existence is on earth and so forth. But still like the actual phrase, the meaning of life, that's or like quite much more recent invention. That the first person to use it in the English language, to use the phrase meaning of life, was this author called Thomas Carlyle. He was a Scottish author living in the early 19th century, and 1834 he published his book Sartor Resartus, which was like quite a big hit at that time. Everybody was reading it, and it was very much talk about both in the British and in the US. Ralph Waldo Emerson, for example, wrote the preface for the US edition of the book. But in that book, he introduced the phrase meaning of life, and he was also like talking about this kind of like going through this existential crisis there in the book. And the book itself was kind of like the existential crisis that he was describing in the book was something that he himself had gone through a few years before.
One reason the meaning of life, looking for the meaning of life, yields unsatisfactory answers is that we expect that there must be a single universal answer. Why is that too much to ask for?
Yeah, so in the book, I distinguish between like two separate questions of meaning. So one question is this question about meaning of life. And that's the question where we are kind of like trying to figure out what is the meaning of life as such? What is like some like ultimate purpose for all life or all human life? So that's one way of asking the question about meaning, trying to figure out like the one answer that applies to all human life. But then there's the other question, which is question about meaning in life. So not of life, but meaning in life. And that's more a personal question about what makes my life feel significant and worth living. So it's a more like a psychological question about how do I experience my own life and where do I derive meaning to my own life. So, and I'm kind of like arguing that, you know, even though answering the first question is not always easy, it's not always, and it might be like, you know, the scientific worldview, for example, has made it like harder to answer the first question. But still, like, whether or not we have an answer to the first question, we still need to have an answer to the second question. And the second question can be like answered quite independently from our answer to this first question. So we can, there can be people who like experience a strong sense of meaning in life. So they feel that their life is very worthy of living. They feel that, you know, they are very like engaged with their life. But at the same time, they might think that, you know, life as such might not have any meaning. So there are two separate questions. And I think that we should focus more on this question of meaning in life, because I think that's actually the more fundamental question and not the more theoretical question about meaning of life.
A great source of meaning in life can be from our relationships. You note that in the 19th century, not so long after Thomas Carlyle, the Romantics came along with this idea that love should be a kind of head-over-heels experience that gives us nothing but pure joy, and that has been a disaster for relationships ever since.
I think like the Romantics are kind of like one group who are, I don't know, is it too strong to that, to blame for like this modern romantic notion that, you know, that we see in the Hollywood movies, that, you know, that we fall head over heels in love, and, you know, the first moment we see, lock our eyes on the other person, we already know that this is going to be the person that I'm going to, you know, share my life for the rest of my life, and I'm going to love this person, and the love is going to be like staying the same years in or years out. And of course, that's like, you know, quite hard from the reality that most people's love affairs and most people's like marriages go through, that, you know, most marriages have their ups and have their downs. And that's kind of the reality. And the Romantics also, like, they also, their ideas about work were a bit in the similar way, that they were talking about this, finding this grand calling to your life, you know, that there's some calling waiting for you somewhere out there. And when you recognize this calling, it's going to be, you know, then you know that this is what I was like put on this planet to do. And after that, you never have like any doubts about your career or anything else, because you know so clearly that this is the thing that you strive to do every day. And I think that this notion of calling is like equally harmful as this notion of, you know, love, as this like very romantic love. So in both of these accounts, we should like realize that the life is more complex than these easy picture or these idealized pictures represented as.
So maybe we shouldn't expect to fall for a calling any more than we should expect to fall perfectly in love with another person. But you do think if we're looking for a profound way to make a contribution in life, work is often our best bet.
Yeah, work is, of course, like a big part of our life in modern society. So like, we just like time-wise, we spend like quite big amount of like our waking hours at work when we are adults. So in that sense, you know, that whatever the meaning in life comes down to, work, like work is going to be one of the key places where you're able to, like, you know, satisfy these things that like meaningfulness comes from. So like, if meaningfulness comes from relationships, then your work relationships are going to matter for how much meaningfulness you're going to experience into your life, because you spend so much time in your work. So in that sense, that when we think about the meaning of life, the work is probably going to be like, in many people's life, work is going to be playing quite a key role in satisfying it.
Is it possible to draw meaning from our work, even if we're not doing something that is generally seen as really important for the world?
Yeah, I guess it's more about, you know, one's personal relationship with the work, and not like it's not so like what other people think about the work, but like what you think about yourself about the work. And I think like many people, even in this like so-called like stigmatized occupations, many people within these occupations actually like enjoy their work quite much, even though they are like sad that they don't get the social recognition for their work that they would want to have. But the personality, they might be like quite attached to their work and quite much find like sense of meaning from doing that kind of work.
All right, I want to go to the phone. First up, we have Manuel on the line in Austin. Hi, Manuel.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question for the author. I'm a physician, and in our society, which so frequently focuses happiness on being the acquisition of things and experiences, it seems to deny the simple acceptance of just being. And I was wondering what he thinks about Epicurus' version of happiness, which required three simple things. He said friendship, freedom, and a lack of anxiety, i.e. having food and shelter. And that if we just seem to focus on those things, that in a way we would simply have a happier society.
Thanks for calling.
I think that's a good question. So friendship, freedom, and lack of anxiety was those three things. And I think, when we think about like where our sense of happiness and where our sense of meaningfulness comes from, it's true that, one thing is, of course, that, if you're lacking the basic necessities, if our life is constant struggle to get bread on the table, that's going to be affecting our happiness levels. And it's going to be affect our sense of how much we are able to put effort into things that we find meaningful. But when these basic necessities are satisfied, then the most important things usually where people get this sense of meaningfulness comes from relationships, comes from being able to contribute towards other people on the one hand. So connecting to other people is one of the key ways of experiencing meaningfulness and becoming more happy. And then the other part is this connecting to oneself, being able to do things that, one personally finds worth doing, something that one personally finds interesting and valuable to do. And at the same time, being able to use one's talents, use one whatever one is good at doing, being able to use one's skills in one's activities. I think these are the usual ways of getting where we get this sense of happiness and meaningfulness from. And of course, I think that many people instead of focusing on these things, they focus too much on the materialistic things. And even though lack of material might make us unhappy when we are lacking the basic necessities, but beyond a certain point, having more material, having more money actually doesn't contribute much to our sense of happiness or sense of meaningfulness. Because when we are no longer lacking something, then this extra money usually just comes that we actually often have to work too much to get it. And then we're trying to justify our way of working through purchasing more things, which we actually don't need, but we need to feel that we need them because we need to feel that our work was worth doing. Putting so much effort and so many hours into the work needs to be justified somehow, and buying some new things is one way of justifying that. So in this sense, this materialistic lifestyle sometimes actually can make, it's not the way that we actually get where we want to get if what we want to get is become more happy, being more satisfied with what we have and concentrating on realizing ourselves and concentrating on these close relationships and contributing is actually more kind of balanced way of achieving happiness, in my opinion.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Frank, if our ancestors didn't really worry about the meaning of life back in the time when virtually everyone believed in God, does that suggest we need religion for meaning in our lives, or that finding religion would give us that meaning?
I guess even in modern society, of course, religion is quite important for many people's sense of meaningfulness. So but of course, one thing to note about religiousness today is that it's already a bit different than it was a couple of hundred years ago, because even people who are deeply committed to their religion, they're much more aware of the alternatives. So a couple of hundred years ago, it was possible to live in a community where everybody was believing the same way that you were believing. So you were not even the word atheism as a word was invented only a couple of centuries ago. So before the rise of the scientific worldview, there simply wasn't any alternative to the religious worldview. So only through the scientific worldview, we became aware of the alternative. And because of that, people who believe today, they are more self-aware of themselves as believers. They know people who are not believers, and they identify themselves as believers because they know about the alternative. So in that sense, the way to believe now is also already a bit different, and people who believe are also more questioning the way they are believing. People's beliefs are changing throughout their life, that they might be religious all the time, but there might be more questioning about what kind of God am I believing in, and what kind of religious rituals do I want to participate in. So there's more questioning also within the religious population now than there was a couple of hundred years ago. And at the same time, I must say that, people who don't believe in God, many of them also find their life very meaningful. And they can find their life meaningful through these quite mundane things, that they don't seek the meaning from somewhere from above, but more from these everyday experiences that we can have with each other. But when we are able to do, for example, able to contribute towards other people, when we're able to feel that, you know, my through my work and through my hobbies and through something else that I'm doing, I'm able to make other people's lives better, that's quite an important source of meaningfulness for many people, both like religious people and non-religious people alike. So I think that, you know, these many of the sources of meaningfulness are actually quite the same for, like, no matter whether people believe or don't believe in a specific God.
It's interesting that we find meaning when we turn outward from ourselves, because we spend so much time thinking about what will make us happy and fill us with meaning, and the answer lies in other people.
Yeah, and even like for happiness also, that answer often lies in other people. That I think like the key source of our happiness usually is other people, you know, both through this like close relationships, that, you know, close relationships is one of the key things that, you know, makes us happy and makes our life meaningful. For example, when like a couple of researchers have been like asking people to name one thing that makes their life meaningful. Then people think for a while and then they write down something. And when the researchers go through these answers, what people write, it turns out that even though people could write about anything in the world, most people, you know, three fifths of the people are writing about their like close relationships, that they're writing about their family or about their friends or a certain family member. And then also, like, as regards this contribution, there's also research showing that, for example, this Laura Aitken, who is this like Canadian psychologist, she's shown that when you give $5 to people, and half of the people you say that use this $5 for other people, and half of the people you say that use this $5 for yourself, it turns out that those people who use the $5 for other people are happier afterwards than those people who invested the money in themselves.
My guest is Frank Martella. His book is A Wonderful Life, Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frank Martella. He's a philosopher and researcher of psychology specializing in the meaning of life at Aalto University in Helsinki. He's written a book called A Wonderful Life, Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. Next on the phone, we will speak with Ray calling from Loveland, Colorado. Hi, Ray.
Hi. The question I had was, as you become a better person, you know, the meaning of life should be becoming the best person you can be. And happiness, I would just think that happiness would be a consequence of achieving the goals that make you a better person.
Thank you for calling. What do you think, Frank?
Oh, yeah, that's very, like, I would say that's a very Aristotelian notion of, like, how to live one's life, that Aristotle would very much agree with you on that, that, you know, that we should try in life, we should like strive to be the best version of ourselves, like strive to realize the potential within us. And then like happiness and well-being comes as a side product of this like quest to realize ourselves. And I think that it's quite much true that, you know, that instead of focusing on making ourselves happy, it's much better to focus on making myself better, trying to figure out how can I, you know, better serve my community? How can I better realize the things that I myself find interesting? How can I develop my talents and my become a more, develop like mastery in certain things? I think like through developing ourselves, we can actually make ourselves more happy as a side product, and also like make ourselves more like, you know, the better parts of the society as well. So like both it's a good outcome for both ourselves and for the people around us.
You tell us in the book that a sense of autonomy is good when we're trying to create meaning in our lives, but autonomy is not the same as Western style individualism. So help us understand the difference.
Yeah, so autonomy, as I understand it, and it comes from like this like self-determination theory, which is one of like these key theories of motivation and well-being within psychology today. They define, like, in this theory, the autonomy is defined as like this sense of like self-volition, like choosing whatever you're doing yourself. So it's not about, you know, being like independent from other people. So I can be like, you know, completely autonomous when I'm like with my loved ones, you know, spending time with my wife or spending time with my kids. Like, you know, it's an autonomous activity to me, something that I myself choose that I want to do. So in that sense, like, you know, being like independent, being like independent from other people and being autonomous are two completely separate things. And even like some people can even argue that, you know, nowadays, because our culture is quite, you know, individualistic oriented, that, you know, the culture is like guiding us towards only caring about ourselves and, you know, putting ourselves in the first place in every situation. Then some people who, like, you know, are more autonomous, you're like, who are less accepting of the cultural message, they actually might be like, you know, more other oriented, because they find within themselves the willingness to be good to other people, to think about other people and take care of other people. And through that, they are, you know, kind of like not accepting the cultural message that they should be selfish, and instead, like, you know, autonomously being more other oriented. So in that sense, like, that's one way of like putting the difference between autonomy and this like selfishness. So autonomy is not at all about selfishness, but about, you know, embracing whatever you're doing and feeling that you're, like, you know, kind of like the author of your own life, making choices that are based on your own values, based on your own interest, in comparison of being like just like accepting whatever other people are suggesting what you ought to be doing.
Can we be happy if we don't have values, or if we don't sort of think about what our values ought to be?
Sometimes I feel that some people who don't think too much of them, they seem to be like happier than me, who is all the time thinking about these things. So in a way, like, you know, too much thinking about these values, all the time thinking about one's meaning and everything, it's not always like, you know, it's not always easy. It makes like life more complicated. So sometimes, you know, for example, Leo Tolstoy, who was this Russian author in the 19th century, he was having this grand existential like crisis in his life in several years. And he was like very much envious of the, like, the peasants in his like fields, who were like living very simple lifestyles, who all seemed to be like not bothered about any questions of meaning, but still seemed to be much more happier and much more satisfied with their lives. So in that sense, I think it's perfectly possible to be like happy with one's life without, and even like experiencing one's life very meaningful without ever thinking too much about that. But I guess like it depends a bit, like, you know, that some people are lucky to be born in a situation where they're able to, you know, be happy without having to think about it. But for many people, I guess, like, to find their, like, the place in life where they want to be, where they really feel happy, they have to go through, like, you know, some struggles. Like, they have to, you know, abandon the way of living that their parents were living, or abandon the certain career that they were supposed to be taking. And through only through this, like, this process of self-reflection and making these personal choices, they come to a place where they actually can be like satisfied and happy with their life. So I think that sometimes you can accidentally be happy throughout your life without having to think about it. But for many people, it requires at least at some point that they make these conscious choices about their way of living that like leads them towards a place where they can be happier.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Dale on the line in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Dale.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering if in your research you've run into a correlation between the meaning of life and our DNA-driven need to perpetuate our species, to replicate, to survive, and then the correlation between our happiness quotient and the amount of focus on intent and our gratitude that we find in our existence.
Thanks for calling.
As to your first question, that I think, like, of course, like our DNA, like through because of our genes, we have like certain, like, you know, inherent tendencies within us. And I think, like, you know, these tendencies like guide us in our life to some degree, that, you know, because of these tendencies, we, for example, as social animals, we strive to have like these close relationships, and we feel bad if we are like abandoned by other people. Because, like, you know, in the time, like, in when human beings have been like developing like millions of years ago, our survival has always been dependent on being part of the group. You know, that if the group abandoned you, your like chances of surviving like went down quite significantly. So because of that, we have like these instincts that we want to like make sure that we have like these people around us, and people around us are accepting us, and people around us are kind of like, you know, that we find these close relationships, and through that we find love, and through love we then find like people with whom we can have children. So in that sense, you know, the genes are driving our behavior to some degree, but at the same time, because we have this like this ability for reflection, we can, like, you know, accept some of the messages that come from, like, you know, these instincts, and we can, like, you know, some others we can like just decline to like follow in our life, and like just like live more self-selected lives, which might be like further away from like what the purely genetic point of view would guide us towards living. So like I think that we're not going to be like able to escape it completely, these things that we have from as part of our human nature, but through reflection, through culture, we can like come to value also other things which don't have anything to do with our genes replicating.
And what about gratitude? Does gratitude play a role in helping us find the meaning of life?
I would say so, because like that's one way of like, you know, becoming aware about the things that are already good in one's life. That, you know, I guess like in our modern lifestyle, we quite often we focus too much on the future. We focus on like, you know, some project that we have. We focus on achieving something and think that only when we achieve that something, after that we can be satisfied with our life. But like through gratitude, we can become like more aware of what are the things that are already good in our life. Do we have like already some relationships in our life that can give us a sense of meaning? Are there like things in our life where we can, through which we can like realize ourselves, some hobbies or through our work or whatever? So I think that gratitude might be a good way of becoming more aware of the things that are already part of the meaningfulness of our lives. Because like actually when researchers ask people about the meaning of their lives, most people actually most of the time feel that their life is already meaningful. So like sometimes we might think that, you know, that meaning is something like only reserved for the, like the selected few who are like, you know, making some like grand contribution to the humankind. You know, that if you're able to, you know, cure cancer or something like that, then you're going to feel that your life is meaningful. But otherwise, you are not allowed to think about that. But actually, that's not the truth at all. Actually, most of us, most of the time, already find our lives meaningful. And we find it meaningful through these very mundane, everyday things like having relationships, being able to contribute and so forth. And through gratitude, we can like become more aware of the things that are already there. So in that sense, like gratitude might be a very good way of becoming aware of the meaningfulness already existing within our lives.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You write about taking a bike ride with your little son who had just learned to ride a bike, and how you were able to observe his joy of doing this for the first time and feel that yourself.
Yeah, that was like, as I've been emphasizing, the meaningfulness comes from these small things in life. And that was just like one example from my own life that, you know, when my son was able to like, you know, ride a bike by himself, then we took this like bike ride to this like cafeteria, which is quite close to our home by the sea, and in this cafeteria where we're like kind of like sharing the moment there. And in that moment, I was kind of like thinking about both about the past, you know, where what we have come through, that now the son is already so big that he's able to ride a bike himself. And also I was thinking about the future, that now that he's like big enough for that, there's going to be like many more bike routes with him. There's going to be like more and more interesting conversations with him when he's growing up. So in a way, I felt that was a moment where most of the elements of meaningfulness were quite strongly present. That I was doing something that I love doing, which is biking. I was able to do that with somebody I love being with, which is my son. So like, you know, even though that's quite a mundane moment, you know, having a bike ride with son or something like that, but still I think that it's a moment like that where the meaningfulness of our lives really comes like forward.
All right, back to the phones. This time we will speak with Jeremy calling us from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello. So just speaking as somebody that just until a couple of years ago has been depressed for half of their life, just to be frank, and if we look at it through the lens of if we look at happiness through the lens of those three factors earlier, freedom, lack of anxiety, and relationships, I did go without those chronically for a while, and it was really hard, but the most natural thing for me to do besides following through with the suicidal ideations, the most natural thing for me to do, as if that was the second best choice, was to just go and find homeless people, share food with them, and that automatically lifted me really high up. So my question is, given enough doors, given enough time, can anybody find happiness through giving to others?
Thank you for calling, Jeremy, and I'm glad you're doing better.
Yeah, glad to hear that you're doing better, and thanks for sharing your story. And I think that, you know, what you did, that, you know, you went to the homeless people, shared the meal with them, I think that, you know, that sounds like a powerful way of, like, experiencing meaningful and something that, you know, really can lift oneself up. So in a way, I would agree that, yeah, that whatever our situation, like trying to figure out what is even like some small thing that we can do towards other people that can actually like, you know, infuse more meaningfulness to our lives. So like one story that I remember, I was doing research in a nursing home, and in one of these departments there was like this, like when the linen came in from like the laundry, the nurses had like fold the linen. But in this one department, like two elder ladies, they had taken care of this business. So like when the linen came in, they came to the table and they started to fold it. And when I was observing them like doing this folding, they were like very like, you know, they seemed to be like very like happy and satisfied with themselves being able to do that work. And I was thinking that, you know, given that they were in this like nursing home, they didn't have like much chances to contribute towards other people at that point anymore. You know, that the nurses were all the time helping them with like everyday activities. But there was still this one thing that they were able to like, you know, give back in something to the nurses, help them in some way. And because of that, I felt that, you know, this activity was very like important, very meaningful to these two older ladies. So even in that situation, they were able to still find this one small thing that they were able to do. Of course, you know, holding the linen is not much. It's not like, you know, you're not like, you know, saving the world through that. But still, at that point, that was like the most kind of like meaningful activity through which they were able to contribute that they had like at their disposal. So like whatever the situation one is in thinking about what are the small things that one can still do to contribute towards other people could be like one way of like, you know, expressing a sense of meaningfulness and like hopefully then like through that gaining more control over one's life and one's mood.
Frank Martella is a philosopher and researcher of psychology specializing in the meaning of life at Aalto University in Helsinki. His book is called A Wonderful Life, Insights on Finding a Meaningful Existence. Frank, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks. It has been a great conversation. Thanks for all the callers and their questions. They were like very interesting to try to answer them as well.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. And if you want to subscribe to our podcast, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Just type KERA Think into the search bar or listen to what you've missed on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.